Hey, this is Jay Speak. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'm bringing you something now that I want you to listen to because I think it's fascinating. Thanks, by the way, for hanging in there with me. And I appreciate all the thumbs up and the likes and all the other cool things that you guys do. And thanks so much for subscribing. We're growing so damn fast. And, I'm just putting this out here because I've got so much extra information and I just want to share it with you, especially since it's stuff that you would never be able to hear. For example, if you were living anywhere in a Western country. I just did an interview a little while ago. This guy is so cool. He's a really smart dude. His name is Maxim Nevenchny. He's a Ukrainian politician. He was a big guy in Ukraine, really strong politician. He was like the mayor and the deputy of an entire community. And he shared with me what went down when everything changed, especially when it comes to, for example, the Russian language. Because I've always been mystified where this came from. All of a sudden, one day, they decide that if you speak Russian in Ukraine, you could go to jail, you could be punished, you could get your ass kicked. So I wanted to understand where this came from. I've heard Lavrov lately. Lavrov talks about this stuff all the time, and he seems like he's pissed. It's the one thing that he really sets him off is the fact that Ukraine has made it illegal for people to speak a certain language, which he says is a human rights violation. He's probably right. But more importantly, who manifests this, right? Who controls it? And here's where this gets really interesting. Stay with me here. So as I was asking him about this, he was telling me about, because I said, okay, if you can't speak the language, I mean, what does that mean? They're not going to put signs up in language. School books won't be written in Russian. You're not allowed to speak Russian. What do you mean by it's banned? So he basically said, in his case and in others, and he's not the only one who's told me this, if you defy the Russian language ban, you will literally be visited by people who aren't with the government. They're nationalists. They're like white nationalists and they're assholes and they don't want it to happen. So they make it not happen. And if you then complain, for example, to the government or to the police in your community and say, some people just beat up my husband because he was speaking Russian, they say, whoa. No, we don't mess with those guys. So those people, these nationalists, Nazis is what they are. See, I always thought the Russians were full of crap. When I got here to Moscow, the first thing I thought, and I told a lot of them that I even talked about this on the air, come on, Nazis, there's no Nazis, That's bullshit. Propaganda, you're trying to use Nazis because and I just didn't think it was true until I started looking into this stuff. They really are Nazis. They really wear Nazi emblems. They believe in the ideology of Adolf Hitler. They believe in Bandera, who was a Nazi and, hated Jews and wanted to kill and did all the things that, well, massacred Jews is worse than hating Jews. So these people are really into that stuff. So the question is, why are they allowed to do this? Because they control the government. He says they control Zelensky. And if it was up to Zelensky at the beginning, he wouldn't have been what he has become. This is from a guy who worked with him. This is a Russian politician, by the way. But the most fascinating thing that he told me that I came away with and was kind of a little upset was he says that the people who manifested this were NATO, the Europeans, but especially Washington, especially the US State Department. He said the US State Department used those Nazis to bring about a fearful anti-Russian sentiment in Ukraine. See, Washington at the time, with Victoria Nuland and Biden and Obama in particular, wanted to turn Ukraine against Russia. Ukraine is not naturally an anti-Russia place. The white nationalists were, but not Ukraine. So they needed to feed the white nationalists so they could create this feeling inside Ukraine. So, that bothered me because really, America has been backing Nazis? Well, if you do a little bit of reading on this, you find out that they've actually been doing this for a long time, way before 2014. But if we take it from 2014 on, just, where it is at its will, so to speak, I asked him, you were there, right? You saw it. You saw the marching orders as they were coming in. So he explained to me, yes. And I said, are you sure? Are you positive? that these were coming in from my country, the United States, that they were actually working with the Nazis, promoting these Nazis, et cetera, in the conversation. And what he basically says is, and you'll get this, but he said it didn't matter. As long as they were tools that could be used to punish Russia, to turn people against Russia, it didn't matter if they were Nazis or Schnazis. It just didn't matter. To the United States, they were just, and to NATO and to the West, they were just a useful proxy entity to be able to somehow weaken Russia. And then he goes on to say some interesting stuff about what's going on now, where that same sentiment is being used in other places as well. It's kind of a fascinating conversation to hear, on the very day that we hear that the United States is sending warships and 4,000 Marines into Venezuela. And by the way, Alex Jones is for this. I mean, I had this guy on my show. And he was talking about how bad interventions are and how the United States should never be involved in that kind of intervention. And that he's a guy who's always talking about globalists and neocons and the horrible damage they do. And here we have neocons and globalists who've had this hard-on for Maduro for the longest time. And it's fascinating because, the things that Alex Jones is saying are all wrong. Almost like he's against interventions and the things that we do around the world, but it's okay if we do it in a Latin American country? Why? Why? They're little brown people? I mean, does he not understand that our immigration is a mess in the United States and it's because of interventions? Most of the people who are Honduran and live in the United States would have been happy to stay in Honduras or Nicaragua or Mexico or Guatemala or any of those countries. If we had just left their damn countries alone, they'd still be there. It's like, I don't understand how people don't separate this stuff. Somebody like him, how disappointing that Alex Jones is saying this shit. It's crazy. But anyway, to understand interventions, how they work, you're going to hear from Maxim Nevchinny. And he was there. He saw how the intervention worked. He explains, and I wasn't even trying to drill down on this so much, but he explains what was done and how it was done and where it's led us to. And then toward the end, I'm also going to ask him, and you're going to be interested in this, where's this going to go? And I asked him if he would return to Ukraine, if he could. Smart guy, by the way. He would be a good leader, I think, in any country. And the answer he gives me is kind of revealing and kind of frightening. But I'll let you hear it for yourself. Maxim Nevchinny. Here's my interview with him. Enjoy. I want to introduce you now to Maxim Nevchinny. He's a Ukrainian opposition leader at the time, but he was a pretty big guy in Ukraine at some point. But then he got soured on the politics and what was going on with Mr. Zelensky. He's the former deputy of the city council of Nikolaev. He's also now a member of The Other Ukraine, which is a movement. He's living in Moscow right now, and he's been good enough to come and join us and is sitting here with us right now. Maxim, good to see you. Good to see you. Thank you so much for coming.
Добрый день.
Hey, I was listening to Mr. Lavrov over the weekend, and he seems angry. In fact, whenever I see Mr. Lavrov get heated, this is the issue he's usually talking about. This is a big deal, I guess, for him in particular. But he's angry that people who live in Ukraine are not allowed to speak the Russian language. You have been championing this cause for a long time. Explain it to people around the world who don't understand why somebody would not be allowed to speak a language in some country, for example. Why is this so important?
Ukraine is a country where most of the population actually speaks Russian as their native language. And since 2014, when the second revolution took place, the so-called Revolution of Dignity, a project started that is titled Anti-Russia, aimed at fully breaking ties with Russia and making the once friendly Ukraine an absolute antipode of it, through the policy of militarization, through preparing to a war with the Russian Federation, and through nationalization, which is actually not natural of Ukrainians, because Ukraine mostly consists of two parts. The most part of Ukraine is Russian-speaking population, who have the same values, the same traditions, who grew up on the same films as Russians. Basically, when a person from Kiev comes to Moscow, you would never tell them apart. There's a small territory in the western Ukraine who are more biased towards the Western civilization. And those few people were chosen by the anti-Russia political project as the standard, as the benchmark. After the 2014 Maidan revolution.
And by the way, let me stop you real quick. Those people you just mentioned that live in that small western portion, are they a minority in Ukraine? The ones who speak Ukrainian are a minority?
I'll tell you more than that. Some of them speak with a Polish accent, some of them speak with a Romanian accent or Hungarian accent.
Okay.
Those are basically five territories that for a long time had been under control of other states, and only after World War II they were actually made part of Ukraine. So those five territories, they are, well, special in themselves. They have a very special, like, mentality. So the anti-Russia project, essentially launched by Western special services, was aimed at making those people who have historical, well, grudge against the USSR, against the Soviet regime. Those people were chosen as the benchmark against which all other the rest of the population basically would be measured. So the population of the south of Ukraine, Odessa, Nikolaev, Kherson, Kiev, Dnipropetrovsk, to people of the western Ukraine, they call them Moskals, the derogatory name of Moskals. They say, you are not real Ukrainians, you are more Russians. So after 2014, when the power was basically snatched by the embassy of the United States, as I would put it, because this is where the orders were coming from, the main demand was to break all ties with the Russian Federation. And we understand that Ukraine is part of the Russian civilization. So in order to break that tie, first of all, they needed to ban the use of Russian language, which is basically the main instrument of communication. So everybody was ordered to use the language that is spoken by a minority in Ukraine. Just think about it. There were 52 people in Ukraine, and only 7 million people of 52 spoke that Ukrainian language.
Wow, really? Out of 52, only 7 million speak exclusively the Ukrainian language.
Exactly. So due to these repressive measures, people were forced to speak Ukrainian. And when that anti-Russia project was launched using special technologies, when the embassy took control of the law enforcement, regional administrations, and they duplicated basically the courts of law and all the authorities, and they took control of radical groups who took to the streets. Basically, those were people who would come to your house, beat you up, and when you come to the police and say you've been beaten up, the police would tell you, Rick, we can't do anything. This is their civilian position. They're just expressing their civilian stance. So basically, there's nothing that can help you.
So let me stop you for a minute, because I think people all over the world want to better understand this. So when you say they banned people from speaking Russian, does that mean that it was actually a law, or does it mean they took down all the signs in Russia, in Russian? They told people that they shouldn't speak it, or were they actually out there enforcing it
and trying to catch people speaking Russian and arresting them by law. What exactly does that word ban mean?
So how that was happening, there was the official part, and there was the unofficial part. So I, as a deputy, as a public figure, if I was supposed to speak my language because my voters were Russian-speaking, not everybody of them understood Ukrainian, because Ukrainian is not a totally Ukrainian-speaking state. Basically, in America, there is no American language.
You know, Spanish and English and everything.
Yeah. Take Portugal, take Brazil or Argentina. So we didn't see it as a problem. But for the anti-Russia project to succeed, they needed to force most of the population to use the language that the minority was speaking. So the official part, there was a law dictating that people should speak Ukrainian. And if a person wouldn't agree, they could come to their home, beat them up, or bully them on social media, and basically you could do nothing about it, because otherwise you would end up having problems. You'd be publicly bullied, sprayed with manure publicly, and the police would do nothing about that. And there were patriots, former unemployed people who were.
You know, it's interesting. You're not the first person to tell me this. In other sources that I have spoken to have told me, because when I asked them, I said, so were these members of the government? Were these the police? They say, no, yet. It was not. Apparently, what happened at the time was, according to my sources, and you can confirm this or not, these nationalists, some people say they're neo-Nazis, they were the ones who would go into the community and enforce these things. But the real police and the real people like you who are mayors or council members were afraid of them or didn't have power over them, so they had to sit back and just let it happen. That's what's been told to me. Is that true?
Let me give you an example. In 2017, I was in the public center in the Ukrainian city. I was holding an action to explain to the population what the Minsk Accords were, because most of the people didn't understand what those were. They thought those were like huge volumes that were impossible to read for a common person. And I invited people over, I gave a speech, I told them that the Minsk Accords were just two sheets of paper, two pages basically.
For the sake of our audience that may not be caught up, the Minsk Accord was an understanding that was reached with the help of Europeans, where the Russians and the Ukrainians would agree to give back that land where the Russians were, and also respect the language and religious rights of the Russians that live in that part of Ukraine. And they thought they had an agreement, but they actually didn't. Continue.
Yes, those were accords according to which the Donetsk and Lugansk regions would be integrated in Ukraine according to a certain procedure. And basically they prevented the territories from going outside of Ukraine. But when I was holding that session, that discussion, the nationalists came. They broke in, they barged in, beat me up.
Wow.
It was all filmed by local media. It was all videotaped. They took me in a separate room, beat me up for several minutes, and the local police, well, my status as a deputy, well, the special services and the nationalists, they acted very smoothly. They told, we are taking him out. They couldn't tell everybody that They couldn't tell the nationalists that they're breaking the law. The police couldn't require the nationalists to observe the law. Indeed, the police could only take me away from the nationalists by telling them that they're taking me out to beat me even more.
Wow.
Yeah. And as a deputy expressing the interests of my voters, and voters didn't want any armed conflict to happen. Because back then, what they had in the territory of Ukraine was the anti-terrorist operation in Donbass. Donbass, with its 7 million of population, were declared terrorists. I mean, elderly people, children, all the 7 million of people were declared terrorists. And Ukraine's armed forces were conducting an anti-terrorist operation against those people. So,
you know,
and nationalists would beat up everyone against that.
It makes me want to ask this question, which has come to my mind in the past. If these nationalists are, which I used to think that was just kind of Russian propaganda. I used to think that, you know? Now I've studied it enough and have come to know and believe that there really are Nazis in Ukraine. They really are Nazis. They really worship Bandera, and they really still have the logos, and they really believe in some of the fixtures and some of the ideology of Adolf Hitler, which is crazy to me, but it's there, and anybody else can look it up. If you were doubtful like I was, I don't blame you, because it sounds too weird to be true. But if those people were able to control you and beat you up and control police departments, did they also control Zelensky? Do you think it's possible that when Zelensky first took power, he probably wanted to, because he said he did. He wanted to bring peace to the Donbass, he said. He said a lot of things, but as soon as he got into power, those things went the way. Do you think he was controlled or owned by outside forces like those Nazis or neo-Nazis?
Well, I wouldn't say Nazis were controlling someone. They were an instrument. The Nazis were an instrument in the hands of the embassy of the United States and the scriptwriters who made Soviet Ukraine into an anti-Russia. So to take ultimate control of the system, they needed to replace the law enforcement agencies. I have a book titled How Ukraine Was Made into Anti-Russia, where I, in detail, describe the technologies they used to turn Ukraine into something absolutely opposite, so that later they could use this state in their interests. So when the United States Embassy and the Western Special Services took control of all the law enforcement system and all administrative power in the country, they needed an intimidation action to intimidate the population, because the population wouldn't take this transition to Ukrainian language. The population wouldn't take the narratives where Russians were presented as enemies. What they needed is someone to intimidate the common man, the population, or someone who would be able to come to any state official or any public figure, risking to make any statements going or contradicting the official position. They needed someone to come to that person, to drop them into like a garbage bucket, or bully them, or beat them up. And they called that purification of power, purification of authorities. And those people were considered the epitomes of morality. They were former hobos, unemployed people. And now they're nationalists, they join those ranks, they become respected people, and they do their best to intimidate the people. So when Zelensky came to power in 2019, I'm sure when he was rising to power, he indeed wanted to change the situation. He was representing a population, the majority of which was against the hostilities in Donbass. They were against the Nazification. They were against the anti-Russian hysteria. The population was against Ukraine getting deeper in debt. And when Zelensky came to power, first thing the U.S. Embassy did, and the special services did, they basically made the Nazis attack Zelensky. When Zelensky came to Donbass to actually implement the Steinmeier formula, which was a mechanism of implementing the Minsk Accords, it's basically a roadmap. Zelensky was attacked by nationalists, by Nazis, so he had a conflict with them. This is when he said, "I'm not some schmuck, I'm 40 years old." And the street where the presidential administration is located, the Nazis basically rallied there to that street, and the law enforcers couldn't do anything about that. They were banned, basically, from conflicting. And by that time, all law enforcement officers had been replaced with officers loyal to the West. Basically, it's not just Zelensky. Any president wouldn't have been able to change anything in the system. If you don't want to play by the rules, you'd be exterminated, basically.
So you'd
be declared an enemy.
And I want to go back to that because I'm American. I am a citizen of the United States of America. And I find it troubling to hear your words to me as an American citizen that my country, or better said, the governor of my country, the State Department of my country, literally backed Nazis who they were at war against during World War II, knowing they were Nazis, to help create a new Ukraine. And you seem to be saying that they either did it on purpose or they looked the other way and didn't care that they were Nazis, because what was more important to them at the time was somehow weakening or punishing Russia. Did I get that right? Is that what you're saying?
Look, the main conflict is between the U.S. and the main players, Russia, India, China, and some regional powers like Turkey or Iran. And the U.S., as far as I know, has to come up with instruments where in every special civilization, like in the Russian civilization, they would find part of it and make it the complete antipode. Mm-hmm. We see the same history with Taiwan, unfolding with Taiwan. When a certain part of the Chinese civilization is being used against China, the same story is unfolding in India with Pakistan and Kashmir. The same basically is unfolding in Turkey, in Iran, or in Latin America. Everywhere, there are certain laws and mechanisms where a certain local civilization, be it Latin American or Turkish or Arabic, a small space is created within it that acts destructively, and the United States declares that small destructive piece the benchmark state and starts supporting it. Look at Ukraine, how much money they pumped into it and what it turned into. It's basically a concentration camp where any grown man cannot go abroad. They can lose their lives. They're not free to express any position. They can be killed outside on the streets. Basically, the only destiny they can have is to die in trenches. And certain European authorities and certain Biden administration authorities, it's all said to be done in support of democracy. So they used hundreds of billions of dollars to build a concentration camp in the middle of Europe, basically. But if you come to Ukraine and ask a common Ukrainian if he wants to leave this democracy, he'll be happy to give you everything, anything they can, to stop living in the territory of this so-called democracy.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about that, and I'm thinking now, as I'm watching what's going on in Ukraine, it looks like
Ukraine is a country that is becoming dysfunctional. And maybe it's because I'm not there, but you know the country. I see videos of police officers taking people off the streets. I see this mobilization effort. I see mothers fighting for their sons not to be taken to the front. I see and hear reports of Ukrainians telling the Russian military where to hit the recruitment centers. I see people protesting and marching against corruption. It looks to me like a country that is boiling over and is about to break. How would you describe it?
I think nothing is going to explode. Nothing is going to boil over. Ukraine is currently under total control. Since the beginning of the special military operation, Ukraine at first was at a loss as to what to do next, because most key state figures left Ukraine, basically, in Nikolaev region and in Ukraine. They didn't know what was going to happen. And then special services using terror technologies, they have been able to intimidate people. And now people are afraid of speaking openly because they can always get, because their countrymen, their fellow countrymen can say that these people are pro-Russian, and then those people would immediately be seized and at best beaten up, at worst they'd be tied to a post, left overnight. And then they'd say it were marauders. The point is, there was a certain technology that allowed to immerse the population into an atmosphere of fear, where people would be afraid to speak. They would be afraid to meet with their friends, even in their homes. The situation in Ukraine is getting worse day after day, and anybody bold enough to speak differently, to express common sense, they immediately get repressed, they get jailed, they get beaten up. And trust me, the anti-corruption protests recently, those were not Ukrainians who really think so. Those protesters were sanctioned by the embassy of the United States because Zelensky had attempted to remove authorities that were controlling Zelensky himself. If we see him from the point of view of Ukraine's sovereignty, why would Ukraine as a state need any controlling authorities that are governed from the outside, from the United States? And that brings us back to Zelensky being in control, being very obedient.
Yeah.
And he will continue destroying his own population.
Let me ask you the following question point blank. Do you see any possibility where Ukraine can turn things around and win this war?
Ukraine will never be able to win the war. Ukraine is not actually expected to win it. Ukraine is being used to... Ukraine is expected to die and take as many Russian soldiers as possible with it, to make sure that as many men as possible are conscripted in Russia, to do as much damage as possible. Ukraine is using, it's been used as a weapon against, well, Europe as well, because Russia is trying to build ties with every European state. And the moment Russia builds negotiations with, say, Germany, immediately the Nord Stream is blown up. The moment Russia builds negotiations with Hungary, immediately the Druzhba blows up. This is all done for one simple reason. It's done to prevent any European state to have relationships with the Russian Federation. Instead, they want all European states to obey Ursula von der Leyen, or other representatives of the European bureaucracy. They want European states to lose their sovereignty. They want them to be one big controllable mess.
It's amazing because to hear you describe it, and I think you're right, by the way, I mean, the evidence is there. You know, the EU and NATO are supposed to be organizations that are defensive. They're there not to be aggressive. They're there not to attack. They're there not to accuse. They're there to protect countries from people doing damage to them. But everything you've just said and everything we read is that both the EU and NATO are there aggressively doing everything possible to hurt, punish, even militarily attack Russia. And it's as plain as, you know, the nose on your face. It's crazy to think that these organizations, these European organizations that say they're supposed to do this are actually doing that. It's troubling. Okay, I want to ask you something else. We've got something in the news that I want to ask you about, which is very timely. Apparently, Ukraine, according to reports that we've received here, have actually attacked pipelines. It's called the Druzhba pipeline, providing energy to Slovakia and Hungary. And now on the subject that we were just talking about, those are EU countries. So if Ukraine has done this, why isn't the EU standing up and screaming, hell no, we're not going to let you do that? Where is the punitive action by the EU? Where is the castigation of a country that has attacked several, that has hurt, I guess, attacked other EU countries, if this is the case? What do you make of that?
You know,
the main idea of today's European Union is to form a large confederation managed from one single center to avoid a situation where every separate national government pursues its own policy. From a number of sovereign European states, they are trying to make one big country, basically, if I can put it that way, or one big mechanism, like the United States of Europe. Imagine what would have been in the United States if certain state like Arizona or Texas started pursuing its own policy separately from Washington. What would Washington do to that state? I think it would be very simple. And since the European Union is not quite the organization it was intended to be, they currently need an intimidating factor, a scarecrow. And that scarecrow is the Ukrainians, or Zelensky is being told what to do. And the European Commission says, if you don't listen to us, we can't do anything, but we will ask Zelensky, and Zelensky will deal damage to you. You won't be able to build relationships with China or Russia, and you will listen to us, and you will get the amount of oil and gas and energy that we tell you, depending on how obedient you are, depending on how disciplined you are, and your attempts at pursuing your own policy will be punished. I think it's a form of disciplining countries. Remember when Germany was reluctant to help Ukraine, the Nord Stream went up in the air, and Germany was absolutely different
after that.
Because, trust me, Ukraine, it's masters, they can hurt specific personalities. Like, remember the attack against Fico, Slovakia's prime minister?
That's what I'm thinking. Slovakia and Hungary are two European countries who have been very critical of Zelensky, very critical of the fact that that NATO is arming Ukraine and continuing this war. Is Zelensky, is his government that vindictive that just because somebody criticized him, he's going to blow up the pipelines that supply them with oil? Is that in character for him, you think?
No, that wasn't what I was going to say. It's not about being vindictive. It's about executing orders, fulfilling orders, actually.
Really?
The experience of using street nationalists that was practiced within Ukraine, if you disagree with the official position, then Nazis will come to you and beat you up and do everything they want with you to force you to agree with the official position. This experience is currently being applied within the European Union, actually. And now Ukraine is exactly the thug, the Nazi that comes to you and does everything he's instructed by the European Commission or Western special services. That's one. Number two, look at the scenario of total control of population that's currently being practiced in Ukraine, where no person has rights, but at the same time, everybody is pretending to live in democracy. Basically, people are made to die. People are not allowed to speak about their lives or the destinies they want to have. But, and this, I think this experience will be replicated in other countries. And they will be playing the same game that is played by special services controlling Zelensky.
Let me ask you about yourself personally. I'm very impressed with your ability to explain things so cogently that must be very difficult for the rest of the world. But you've left the country I'm sure you loved. So maybe I should ask the question this way. Did you leave Ukraine or did Ukraine leave you?
Before July, I was in Ukraine. Before July 2022. And of course, I had my problems with law enforcers. I was taken to the police because I was considered a Kremlin agent, and I was thought to be the potential leader of the Nikolaev region. And of course, after lengthy checks, this was disproved. And, well, not everybody in Ukraine actually share this this Nazi thinking. Those people helped me run away in 2022. First, I went to Turkey, and then after a while, I spent some time in Turkey, and then I moved to Russia.
What would have happened to you? What would have happened to you if you'd stayed in Ukraine, do you believe?
I think if I'd stayed in Ukraine, if I lost like the information campaign, just to show the society that they have everything under control, just to prove that they caught a Russian agent, I think they would execute me or just made a demonstration out of that. I think this could have been like a news material for 2 or 3 days.
And they do that. And they do that. But they do that.
Yes, they catch Ukrainian nationals. They show the damage they have done, and they tell we're losing the war, but we are punishing our traitors. And you know what's interesting? What they are charged with? Those people say we shouldn't have that war again. We should decentralize the power. Let the Western Ukraine speak Ukrainian. Let the rest of Ukraine speak Russian. Let one region have monuments to Bandera. Let others region have what they want. This was considered a pro-Russian position. People were not allowed to speak like that. And people understand that. They realize that, but they're afraid of saying that this is stupid because they could get punished.
We have 2 minutes left in the interview, and I want to ask you something personal again. If things work out and there's some kind of peace that allows the great Ukrainian people to have dominion over their country again and be a neutral, independent country, and allows the Russians to pull their military back as well, You seem to me like a very intelligent man. You're obviously very well read, and you explain yourself very well. You seem to me like you have the makings of somebody who would be a good leader. Would you consider going back to Ukraine? And what position would you like to have?
No, I wouldn't consider that. I say that in the near future, Ukraine is going to have a very troubled time. It's going to be a time of trouble with lots of terrorist attacks and special services. Even if peace is signed within the next 6 months, lots of special services from the West, they are going to do their best to do as much damage as they can. And I think they will exterminate any people expressing, well, sensible positions. So for 6 or 12 months in Ukraine, even if it remains as a sovereign state, it's going to be a lot of trouble there. And there will be lots of criminal rumbles, and law will be in the last place, and it will be the right of the rule of the strongest, I think. I wouldn't be part of those events,
really. Sounds like it's going to get ugly before it gets good. And judging from a lot of experts who've spoken about the same thing or similar situations, historically speaking, in the past, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense. Mr. Deputy, thank you so much, sir, for coming and sharing your information with us. We thank you very much for your wisdom. That's our show. Thanks so much for being with us. We try and bring you perspectives that you wouldn't be hearing anywhere else, and that's why I think this conversation with Mr. Maxim Nemenchini has been so important. You can check out our podcast, by the way. We'll put some cuts from this on there. It's called Journalistically Speaking. It's on YouTube, and I'm on X, and you can find me at Rick Sanchez TV. I'll be looking for you there as well, and we'll see you next time.